always been looking forward to having a little bit more time to speak here at Holden. I was here 2 years ago, and I was here for just, seemed like a very short period of time. I think it was just quite literally 2 days. And had an opportunity to meet a couple times, and only kind of felt like we began to deal with some, I began to at least get to the point where I felt like I was making some sense of this question. Because my role in dealing with the deaf culture and the hearing culture has been a journey by itself. So this opportunity here in Holden is not an end point. It's not standing on a stage and telling you what I found. It is more simply saying, well, I've gotten to a certain point in a very long road, and this is a great opportunity to at least stop and reflect and do some discussion and bring people in on the discussion. So I don't see today and tomorrow, if you wish to come the same time, and the next day, Friday, the same time, because we'll be, I'll be here today, tomorrow, and Friday. Consider it really just that, a request, an invitation, to carry on a discussion regarding some of the things that I've found, that I've also bumped into, but which is a way in which we oftentimes gain information and experience. And it gives me the opportunity to put it in such a way to get some reflection back. And for those of you who have the opportunity to either teach or to train or to, at points in time, interact with groups, you know that there are only two types of groups in this world, right? There are those that give and those that take away energy. Somehow there only seems to be those two. Why I came back and why I enjoy coming back here after 2 years is that I certainly felt 2 years ago after having this opportunity, here was a group that certainly I left with more energy than I started with, so that's always great. And so the invitation is to continue. So this is not going to be a lecture. It really is going to be some ideas with some questions, but I also invite you to enter into the discussion vehemently, especially when you agree with me. But more importantly, when you disagree with me. Because that's where I think we all kind of learn a little bit more. I would just real quickly like to hear who's in the room. There are a couple familiar faces and more than even when we started now that I know Beth. But I'd just really be interested to know just who you are and where you folks come from. I'd just be curious. Would you start over here, please?
I know it was going to be a bad idea to start in a seat.
I don't mean to give you the tough question right off the top here. I mean,
Robin Hartwig.
Okay, yeah, that's good enough.
This is hard. I'm currently in Berkeley, California. Just finished 4 years of seminary at Pacific Lutheran Theological Seminary. Is there other things that you're?
That's fine. No, that's helpful, Robin. Thanks. I'd like to introduce my wife, Colette Lajos, who I've been able to convince to come with me for this.
Nice to be here.
Yes.
Thank you.
But I won't introduce her at all. Go do it yourself, Colette.
I'll do it myself. You, well, I'm Tom's wife.
No. You know, this is on tape, Colette, so I just want to make sure so I can prove it now.
No, hopefully I'll be wanting some of my time as well to speak on holistic medicine, field and do acupuncture and herbal medicine. So be looking, if there's something of interest to you, be looking out for a time when I'll be posted at the one of these days.
I joke with my wife. Yesterday was our, we were married in 1990, and yesterday was our 13th wedding anniversary. Let me explain that we were married twice. Once on the 15th of July, and then once on the 11th of August. So we figured it's a good way to kind of accumulate numbers real quick and kind of get through all that kind of messy short stuff. So thanks, I'm happy to have you here. Yes,
Linda from a suburb of Seattle.
Aha. Uh-huh.
I'm not still sure what else you'd like to know.
That's good enough. That's just
okay?
Give me a geography. It's great. How about you, Ben?
I'm Beth Lockhart, and I coordinate Deaf Ministries.
National Council of Churches.
National Council of Churches. Thank you.
And work as a mission developer at a Deaf Lutheran Church, and also in the seminary, and teach American Sign Language, and include some deaf culture in that. Also a deaf adult literacy class. And a mom.
Okay. Yes, sir.
From Leroy Elwing from Santa Clara, California. And I belong to the Christ the Good Shepherd Lutheran in San Jose. And I've been interested in years from Cal Lutheran University while I was college and began when they had the chicken coop 35 years ago or something. I never went to it, but I helped with the thing there. And the seminary in Berkeley, I knew Schmallenberger, and I've been interested with that. So I want to know a little more about Holden Village. I was here 27 years ago.
Ooh.
So keep up a little interest with all these things.
Thank you.
I'm Connie Larson. I was here a couple years ago when you spoke, and I'm with my family, including Marissa, my 11-year-old who is hard of hearing and uses an ASL interpreter and lives kind of between hearing and deaf worlds.
I'm Ruth Scott from Spokane, Washington.
Just for a minute.
I'm Bill Lockhart, and Beth's husband, and from Pennsylvania, and director of a social service agency that works with on deaf and hard of hearing issues.
I'm Lori Scott, and most recently from here, but I'm now in Tacoma, Washington, and I teach deaf children.
I'm Delva Van Rolkel. I'm the director of ed at the Washington School for the Deaf in Vancouver, Washington.
I'm Betty Jago. I'm from Yakima, Washington, and I was a nanny for two children for 7 years, and this lady helped the handicapped find employment. So naturally, they use sign language a lot in their home. Of course, the kids tease me all the time.
Thank you.
I'm Joan Morelli from Yakima. And the only experience I have with deafness is my oldest son, who is quite deaf.
Thank you.
This is my son, Jim Gore. He is both deaf and severely mentally retarded, but autistic tendencies. And I'm his mother, Bill D. Gore.
Great.
I'm both from Seattle.
Welcome. Yes, back there.
Hi, I'm Mary Richards, and I'm deaf, and I'm here to be involved. I'm enjoying myself.
And yes, thank you.
I'm Carol Lee Hewitts. And I took sign language when I was in seminary because I wanted to learn more about how to use my body in preaching. and in the process met wonderful people. And since then, I have tried to pick up sign language whenever possible because I know it's important to be able to communicate with hearing and non-hearing people the best way possible.
Thanks. Just gives us a little opportunity to understand where, at least geographically, in some way philosophically, where people are. I would like to start by telling you how I interpreted the theme for this season, the idea of no longer being strangers, because if I have the opportunity here to speak about cultures, about two very specific cultures, deaf and hearing, and to be able to look at them from a very specific frame. And that frame is that I did not choose to be involved. So this is not a case where I had planfully thought out that this was going to be an avenue of exchange or interaction. And so I'm not delivering this message from inside a culture saying I wanted to understand another culture. In some ways, it is more a story of almost kind of wonderment as to why I land up being at any one spot. Because it wasn't planned. And in terms of the role that I had played and am playing in some respects regarding trying to understand deaf and hearing culture is from another context, which is my role is dealing with social conflict as a researcher, as a teacher. I'm a fellow at the Humphrey Institute in the University of Minnesota, which means that we carry out research in this very specific area, and our area is the idea of social conflict systems. So I teach people and consult with people who wish to know how to negotiate better, how to handle social conflict better, and from a number of different aspects. Not just the skill building of how do you negotiate on a one-to-one basis, but also the idea of designing systems. How do we go about designing good conflict systems? So there's a number of different phases of that kind of responsibilities and jobs that I've had. Okay, so what about all the soup? Let's go back to 1987. I've been asked a number of times, well, how did I ever get involved with the deaf community, with the deaf culture? Because I'm not deaf. I don't come from a family or a group of friends even that I can even identify anybody in my young life or middle-aged or even that I would even have recognized as being deaf. So I don't have that type of a history. And in reflection, recognize that it's not so much that I didn't know that those people existed, but in fact, I was choosing not to be involved. It was choiceful because deaf culture is there. But being raised by parents who had come to the United States and specifically wanted their children to be in the right schools, in the right neighborhoods, dealing with majority issues, very methodically you kind of stay out of dealing with those subcultures that seem to not be central. The deaf have always been there. Did I know about them? I knew of them theoretically. Did I know anybody? No. Okay. So how did I get involved in the deaf culture? It was because of the Intifada. Right now, if that doesn't necessarily make sense, it means it's an ongoing condition in my own professional life. Many of the things that I land up doing don't necessarily make sense in that I can say I know where it started and know where it ended. So let me just tell you my story to complete that question. Number one, the Intifada began because of the contest between the Palestinians and the Israelis, most recently in 1986 and 1987. Intifada means...
Which years?
86, 87. Okay. Intifada means a rising up, a coming above. And it was the idea that the Palestinians were now going to take this anger and fear and put it on a different level than where it had been before. And it also has the sense of coming above or move together, not individually, but doing it together. I began my professional role as dealing as a mediator, meaning a party who supports other people in dealing with conflict, in 85 and 86. There was an interesting group in Minnesota. There were six Israeli women and six Palestinian women who would gather every month in an attempt to meet, to try to understand this craziness taking place in Palestine. And they would meet and things would explode. They would meet, things would explode. They asked me if I would be willing to mediate with them, meaning simply to sit there with them and to support the interaction between these two groups of women who came from radically different cultures, they thought. But the reason why I was invited was, for a whole bunch of reasons, of what I was not. I was invited because I was not female. I was invited because I was not Palestinian. I was invited because I was not Israeli. I was invited because I was primarily out of that white male culture and with some sense of skills, hopefully, that might be able to support this interaction between these two parties. The reason why I mention that is, as an initial condition of my trying to understand how other people conflict and dispute, one of the advantages that I've been able to use, and one of the keys to the notion of culture and understanding culture and how cultures conflict, is to be able to understand more what are the differences rather than what are the similarities. And I say that because when we talk about this idea of changing from somebody who is a stranger to somebody who is no longer a stranger, when I look back at the way people have been writing regarding the notion of culture and the way cultures conflict with one another, a lot of the work has been done based on what I've considered to be a very difficult and almost false premise. And that is that in order to be able to deal with somebody else's culture and truly understand it, you would have to, quote, either stand in that person's shoes, to use one cultural metaphor, sit in that person's seat, you know, take on that person's personality. And it never worked for me. It never worked for me because I always felt it was so incredibly haughty to think that anybody else can really go ahead and understand who I am and understand my experience. And so I rejected that model out of hand and attempted to try to understand how would one deal with differences, especially cultural differences. If we put that initial premise aside, that was very popular in all many aspects of certainly the majority culture, and instead took a different slant and said, you know, what is it that two or more cultures appear to need when they are searching for a different path? And one of the common themes that I would see, whether it was the Palestinians and the Israelis, or whether it was very traditional black-white minority-majority issues, or whether it was questions of civil wars, of which there are 78 going on in the world right now, most of them revolving around concepts of culture or ethnicity or whatnot. The issue is that one or both of them are trying to grapple with specifically that issue. How do we land up dealing with one another and not be strangers, but also to remain individuals, so that my identity does not have to be corrupted in order to be able to deal with the other culture? And as soon as I start with the premise that, well, what we really want is I want you to be me and I want me to be you and we want to part, that violates that initial premise. And so when we began to study, and when I say we, I mean a group of people in the United States, very specifically since the early 80s, that have begun to develop a much more rigorous review of social conflict. How do organizations, individuals, cultures seem to conflict with one another? And it hasn't been, except for maybe the last dozen years, that people have really attempted to apply some rigor to that discussion. But one of the things that kept coming out of that discussion was precisely this testing and finding it wanting, this premise that in order to be able to go ahead and resolve or to manage a conflict between cultures, you had to start with this notion of trust. You know, I trust you, you trust me. It doesn't work because if I start with the concept of trust in order to engage you in something that we are conflicting over, it's exactly the request for you to do what you've already said you can't do. Mm-hmm. And so I that never made sense to me. It just never made sense. So here I get invited to sit with the Palestinian and the Israeli women. It was a phenomenal experience, because I had the opportunity to see and understand the complexities of that incredible conflict in a manner that I just simply would not have had. Okay. One of the outcomes of that? I found that there was this group called ACMED, the American Coalition for Middle East Dialogue, which was
Could you do that again?
I'm sorry, yes I will. I found that there was this group called ACMED, ACMED, the American Coalition for Middle East Dialogue, which was a rigorous and rather wide spread, what's referred to as second tier diplomacy. Ongoing, rigorous, diplomatic, social, conflictful discussions among real people. They weren't diplomats, they weren't politicians, they were people who were honestly concerned about this craziness going on. And so they had a meeting in Boston in 1988. And the meeting was the national meeting for the American Coalition for Middle East Dialogue. Okay, I'm building this road here, folks. Stay with me. The puzzle is coming along. Okay. And the meeting was held in Boston. Now, it being a real grassroots program, You didn't go to the Hilton. You stayed with families. They would bring you in. They'd put you up with a family. And you went to the little conference, and you went back home and stayed with the family. And just by sheer luck of the draw, or by the beauty of God's wisdom and all her understanding of what we can or should be doing with our lives, I landed up in the house of Anita Small.
Yeah, I'm just not
sure. Okay. Now, Anita Small had just completed a degree in audiology. She was working with this school called the Learning Center for Deaf Children. Matter of fact, she only referred to it as the Learning Center. I think I was in her house for 2 days until I realized it was a school for deaf children, because she referred to it as the Learning Center. And then we would have these long discussions at night about the discussions we would have during the day regarding the Palestinian-Israeli issue and the direct parallels that she saw happening between the deaf and the hearing in the school that she was working. And so I just simply became part of that discussion. And if we begin to look at these parallels, what seems to be some of the common rhythms? I come at it from an academic's point of view, so I enjoy the notion of looking at the concepts and how, in fact, they are parallel and how you can analyze it better and can people find a better or more rigorous way to understand what's going on. So we left that experience, and as I was leaving the Smalls' house, she said, you know, maybe I could give you a call in a little while, because I think things are happening in our school, and maybe you can give me some help in terms of dealing with some of the issues. Okay. 6 months later, I get a phone call from her. Get invited to the Learning Center for Deaf Children in Framingham, Massachusetts. And I meet people, and I'm introduced into this culture. That was as foreign to me as if I were dropped off in Saudi Arabia. I had no context for it, meaning I had truly lived my life and been capable of doing it. So I'm not, once again, I'm not even saying that this was somehow planful, but it was choiceful. I found myself now being invited into a culture in a most intriguing way, because I was never a stranger. I was never invited as a stranger. And it was a bizarre feeling. I had been in many different places around the world, and I felt very strange in very different places. I feel very strange in places in the United States oftentimes. But for some reason, Anita Small and Marie Phillips, her colleague, had decided that they were going to go ahead and bring me into the front door of this culture. They sent me documents, they sent me literature, they sent me research, they sent me books. They went ahead and gave me articles to make sure that I understood key words in the culture. They simply decided they were going to take me and shape me into something that they felt could support a very difficult question they were raising. And the question was, how can we go ahead and move an organization, this school, the Learning Center for Deaf Children, from a point where everybody, just literally almost everybody in the school, was clear regarding the minority and majority relationships. Now, not necessarily minority in terms of numbers, and that's one of the tricks in dealing with cultural conflict. is that we talk about it in terms of minority-majority, but we sometimes translate that into some kind of arithmetic, that we mean numbers. I don't mean that. I mean, we need to talk about minority-majority in terms of power. Now, tomorrow, I want to talk about power. I don't want to talk about power today, because tomorrow, I want to talk about two things, power and trust. Today, I just want to be able to tell my story. Okay. So we get in there, the question is this. How do we get into an organization that is truly grappling with trying to find a new balance? And doing it in such a way that they are not blind to the notion that there's all kinds of conflict coming down the line. They had already arrived at a point strategically that seldom, if ever, other organizations have been able to do. I don't know why. I mean, there would be a whole other question. And I think I don't know why, I'm also inviting you to help me to understand this better. But here was one school that said, we no longer can exist to supply education to young children from 18 months up to the end of high school year. We no longer can do this in our society, doing it the way we have, where we have got the hearing culture telling the deaf culture how to be deaf. Okay. And how are you going to go ahead and now build the bridge? So the question was, can we build an arena? Can we build an arena, and I use the term in a very specific way, because when we're talking about cultures in conflict, the keys that we're looking for is not so much the idea of what is good or bad or right or wrong about this culture, or good or bad or right or wrong about this culture. That never works. Just it's as lousy a strategy as trying to be the other culture. The only thing that seems to have had any effect has been to be able to help the cultures understand how to build a culture around an arena into which they can now dispute. So you have got to figure out some way in which these parties can come into the arena, carry out an authentic conflict in a way in which the options and opportunities for success are greater than if they are attempting to carry the disputes outside of the arena. Okay. That's a very complex question, because what is some male Jesuit-trained Easterner of the hearing culture doing, trying to support hearing and deaf individuals to construct this type of an arena? It revolved around a couple strategic points. Okay. Number one, it revolved around the point that people had to accept the fact that a shift was taking place. So the question was not, can you stop the change? And it was clear in the organization as a whole, they were all willing to accept that it had started, and in fact, they can't stop. So they found themselves at a crossroads. I can either see conflict as something which is bad, negative, I've got to do away with it, I'll avoid it. Because when I do conflict stuff, things go bump, people get hurt, I don't get what I want, I get threatened. The power issue now comes up because my power gets really threatened. And by being able to go ahead and have to face that, I'm very uncomfortable. What's my other choice? Well, my other choice is, how do I understand change in our society and understand the very positive and critical and, in fact, essential role that conflict plays in being able to move from stage one to stage two to stage three. And so question number one was, how do we get the organization past denial? What was the question among the Israeli and the Palestinian women? Same thing. They spent a year and a half rigorously grilling one another so that no party had the opportunity or the luxury of denying facts and reality. What did it mean for the Palestinians? It meant being able to prove that Palestine existed. It meant bringing stamps from the last century to prove that you could send a letter from Palestine that had a Palestine. I mean, that literal translation. For the deaf and the hearing, it meant things like this. First meeting I had with the deaf and the hearing, I wanted to get everybody in one room. It was a group about 112 people. Okay. Got them all in there. Third of them were deaf. Two-thirds of them were hearing. And one of the things that we began to talk about was what did we do in this particular organization that made people feel like strangers? I'll go back to the word. Okay. Because power has a way in an organization of being able to make people feel estranged from one another. And dominant or majority and minority cultures have a way of keeping this kind of paradoxical interaction, that the majority is capable of controlling the minority and at the same time making them feel estranged from the majority, right? So there's this dialectic, this sense of tension upon which the relationship is built. So how could we pose that to the deaf and the hearing? One of the questions that came up, that I didn't raise, that got raised in the group itself. Because I was the naive stranger at that point, being invited in, and because I am not a whole bunch of things, I wasn't deaf, right? I was really brought in as a stranger. I can ask the really naive questions. That's a value of coming in from the outside. That is a value that the stranger has. That is something that the power of the stranger will always be. Because I could come in and I could look at this group and I can ask questions that didn't make sense. For instance, one of them was, I had the opportunity to observe a bunch of young children, 5, 6-year-olds, and in a classroom setting. Because it was this wonderful way in which Anita and Maria were folding me into the culture. They would bring me in. They would let me watch what it really meant to be and what happened in classrooms, just so I had a sense of the flavor. Okay? And I noticed that these kids, all of them had this strange little box around their neck. It was a little thing with a dial on the front, and it had earplugs. And they had told me already about the statistics about this school. X number percent were profoundly deaf. X percent had some audio response. So there's these gradations. They were telling me already that it's life is simply not deaf or hearing. That in the deaf culture, you have all these different systems and interactions and whatnot. But I would see all these kids walking around with these boxes on. And in fact, I found some of the staff members also had these type of boxes on. And so I asked the question. I said, well, what is this? I mean, what does it do? Because while you're sitting there and I look at you, I can't tell if you're deaf or hearing. I can't. You all look the same. I can see who's got this kind of yellow and white box on them, and I, what is it? And there was absolute silence among everyone. And then there was one man. He went through the entire school from the time, I guess, he was 4 or 5. He graduated, went out into the hearing culture, got a degree, came back to the school, and now is a teacher. And he was mid-20s, 25, 26, 27 at that point. And he stood up, everybody was sitting, he stood up. And he took this box and he ripped it off of his neck and he threw it against the wall.
He did that?
That passed.
He threw it against the wall. Okay. And he announced that this is the first time that he recognized that that was the same thing as having a shackle around his ankle as a slave would. Mm-hmm. He said, I've worn this thing for 20 years, and every time I put it on, I never knew why I was putting it on. Because it's never worked, I've never heard anything, I never will, but I put it on each time. Okay. Okay. I didn't understand what was going on. I truly didn't. I can reflect on it years past and say, wow, something really happened there. Was I responsible? I wasn't responsible for that. Who was responsible for it? The organization and some wonderful people invited a stranger into a condition and simply allowed the stranger to ask questions that the people themselves couldn't ask. And so cultural conflict and dealing with cultural conflict, seldom, if ever, anything I've ever read or tried to understand, and we've been studying this for a while, is ever the ability to tell somebody something. It is always the ability to somehow ask the question. And so cultural conflict is, from my point of view, not a declarative sentence. It is not stating what is. It is a constant interrogation. And so the people who seem to do it better are the people who almost appear to be more naive. Talk about another paradox. Because it's from that naivete that they are able to ask questions blindly that force the cultures to have to deal with the things that they have been hiding themselves. No longer strangers. It's not me, the one who's brought in as a stranger, because I'm always going to be the stranger. I am never going to be deaf. I'm never going to be part of the deaf culture. I may become deaf part of my life. I don't know what's going to happen to me in the future. But I know what I know about the deaf culture. I cannot simply say, okay, I am going to now become part of the deaf culture. That's not necessarily my decision. I can become part of it in some shaping and be considered part of that. But I have come from a different culture. Now, where do we go in the future then when we want to understand how to support cultures in the way in which they conflict? Okay. How are we doing for time, by the way? Am I closer?
15 minutes.
15, great, okay. Because I want to keep quiet and ask some questions. Paul Tillich was a was a theologian in the 50s and 60s. And when I go back and I think of some of those root idea things, that seems to have been a basis for what I do now in a lot of different ways. There's a great little book by Paul Tillich called The Courage to Be. Okay. And the basic thesis of the book was that when he really tries to figure out what seems to have been the conditions where social change took place and held, it stuck, was seldom, if ever, a condition of certitude. It was seldom, if ever, at a point where people knew exactly where they wanted to go and knew how far they wanted to go and knew when they were going to get there. It would be precisely in the condition of doubt, as he said, the exploration and, in fact, the celebration of doubt as the initial condition inside which change took place. And what I land up doing, whether it's dealing with the deaf culture or whether it's dealing with people who are mediating difficult cases between individuals, whether it's work that I've done in Moldova, whether it's training judges in Paris, whether it's doing work in the Czech Republic, it all still comes down to that initial condition. What I try to do is I try to be able to create for people and for organizations space or arenas where they can authentically expose the doubts that they have, not the certainties. One more statement and then I'll stop. Now let's look at cultures and minority and majority conditions. What locks the horns of that particular conflict is that if you are in the majority, if you have to acknowledge that there is some doubt involved regarding the ability to maintain your role of majority, you now begin to threaten that role of yourself. If you doubt the fact that you should be the majority or you should have the power, it becomes threatening of itself. But there's an intriguing paradox as well. One of the ways in which majority groups keep power over minority groups is that they have been able to teach the minority people to always doubt any power that they may have. Right? Okay. So just keep that idea there for a minute, because what that gives us is one of the few opportunities we have to build arenas that can reconcile that ongoing conflict of between majorities and minorities. Because if you can take doubt as something which is positive, it's one of the few things that the minority group understands and can say, I can do that. I've been doing it all the time. You've taught me really well that if I think I'm powerful, doubt it. And the reason why I should doubt it is, well, I really can't be part of the majority, so therefore. So they're much more at ease in the doubt. So it's not the problem of moving the minority into the area of doubt. It's the problem of moving the majority. So what has to happen? The majority has to somehow get to the point where they're willing to give something up. That they make the first move. Because the minorities are always making the first moves and they're getting beaten up for it. Okay. That's the story of the book. I just simply wanted to throw out some basic ideas, concepts that I see working in an ongoing way regarding conflict cultures and my role in it. Tomorrow, what I want to talk about is power and the relationship of power and trust and how those two things go bump. Okay. I've got questions. What questions do you have of me? What made sense? What didn't make sense? Where do you think you would expand on those ideas or contradict them, if you wish?
I really saw some parallels with aggressive, assertive, and passive.
Okay.
And both the aggressive and the passive, the aggressive interacts with passive out of having to have, it has deficiencies, and the passive has deficiencies. And the I'm hearing that in a majority is like the aggressive. They don't own up or acknowledge their own doubts. And they find power in trying to deny those doubts. Whereas the passive have doubts and live in them and never doubt that they don't have doubts.
Sorry. And are reinforced in
that's right. Yes. And it strikes me that we as human beings have such difficulty with differences. We have to put labels on them as right or wrong, good or bad, out of our own deficiency, our own esteem, kind of. If we were to be if we were to have esteem around ourselves, we would move to the assertive level in that trio. And we couldn't be engaged by an aggressive or a majority. It doesn't matter if it's, you're talking about ethnic and culture or races. If you put a group of people in a room, they're all purple. They'll find one that has a little white dot somewhere, and they'll create a distinction and a right or wrong or good or bad around it. Somebody's going to do that. And they're going to do that, they'll create that right or wrong, good or bad, out of their own deficiencies.
Yes.
It just comes at me from a whole bunch of different angles. And you're working it with the cultural, with the deaf culture and the hearing culture, and it's the same kind of generic issue with international, or white or black,
yeah,
or religion.
Has to do with the notion of competition.
Yeah.
And Friday's when we'll talk about competition a little bit more.
How about domination?
Domination is the same thing in terms of competition, where it becomes a tautology in the sense that it keeps fulfilling itself. Especially if you can say the reason why I have to dominate is that God told me so. Because I am fulfilling then not only my own sense of pride and chauvinism, I am doing it on behalf of someone else who has given me the instruction, the authority, and the power to do it. Domination, what's the word? Comes from Latin, dominus, Lord, God. To dominate means to rule. Ruling is always based on power, and ruling power is ultimately intended to come from a higher source, because that's the ultimate power. Because it cannot be challenged. It can be threatened. But it cannot be. At least that's the argument of our forefathers. That's the argument. What else? Other points you wish to raise?
Michael. Well, I was. I'm always sort of curious, and I know from the inside about some of the conflicts in center schools for the deaf. But having moved into community services, on deaf and hard of hearing issues. So many of the issues aren't even on the table. To be discussing what could possibly be meant about taking that thing off and throwing it against the wall.
Yeah.
So the challenge is trying to find an arena constantly, whether it's in the Department of Corrections, the Department of Mental Health, Department of the court system. They all have their own arenas, and they don't want anybody else to get in, because we are already providing services to the full population.
Yes.
And in fact, ADA says we are not to set up specialty services for anyone.
Yep.
And it's like, so that sense of doubt comes back. We are following. And I bet. So that has been something as a establishing a beginning organization, is trying to find a place to begin a dialogue when the doors are closed.
Yeah.
There's no money out here. It's all in there. And so you're constantly saying, no, that's very cute what you're doing, but we do mental health, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
What a paradox. And I truly don't understand it. I know it because I've seen it and I experienced it. But I truly don't profess to say that I really understand the dynamics. But the paradox is this. The arena building that you talk about, which is the missing, one of the major missing pieces in the whole area of social conflict. Missing pieces meaning when people are having social conflict, what you normally do is somebody tries to get somebody well-trained. Well, let's train them better in negotiating skills and self-assertiveness or value clarification. And they got this whole mantra of things. All right. Without even the notion that you have to have already designed an arena in which you put those skills. So you just simply shotgun the skills out there. And then hope that somehow they're going to trickle down or hit the right spot. What a crazy concept. And then they wonder why those things don't work. The missing piece is the arena building or the design side. Okay. But what's really the greatest paradox? The greatest paradox is the best arenas that I think we've been able to find. In almost every condition had a very similar condition. And it goes back to the stranger that somehow invited into the arena was one element other than the minority group or the majority group or the two minority groups that we're fighting. Or seldom is it even two, three or four or five. Or what? That the necessary and sufficient condition of the arena was the availability or at least the acknowledgement that somehow the non-minority, non-majority, we're back to the Palestinian point, the non-male, non-Palestinian, somebody who was a whole bunch of nons but whose role was there precisely to prick the doubt, precisely to go ahead and be able, not with any malice or forethought, simply out of their ability to ask questions that don't seem evident to him or her. Okay. That's the barrier. That is the barrier. If we find ways in which we can introduce the honored stranger in those arenas, we get phenomenally positive results. Why don't we? There's fear of the stranger. The stranger is somehow going to go ahead and discover something that I don't want discovered. I have a fear of the stranger because I'm afraid that person is going to tell somebody else. That the stranger is going to leave and tell some other group of the problems that we're having. And so we don't want somebody carrying that. We don't want somebody carrying that message out. Okay. We don't bring the stranger in because if we do, we no longer are able to play the games we play to maintain our power while making it look like we're not maintaining our power. I walked away from a consultation just a month ago, which was incredible. I mean, I've learned more from that than I have in many consultations where I've stayed in and been successful. Because it was the school district, and the school district was imploding. It's falling apart. I mean, it has major fundamental cultural problems in simply being able to go ahead and teach and train the students that they're responsible for. You've got a superintendent who is saying, I don't know how to deal with this. I need some help. Help me with a process. Set it up. I say, I'll be happy to do it. And here's the criteria. It's going to be public. It's going to be on top of the table. And so the only way we're going to come up with an agreement is the community is going to, in fact, make a decision. So nobody's going to get trapped or caught having to go ahead and take the big hit, get them out of the crosshairs. Okay. All right. But what do? I do it. We set up a process that does it. Everything's on top of the table. What happens? Fundamental rejection of the stranger. Why? Because, just kidding, you know, you mean somebody else is going to make a decision that I'm not going to be in control of? This is from the inside of the district. And I said, yes, that's what we talked about. Well, you know, I still need to keep control over this and this and this and this. No, yes, you still will be in that role in the future, but the community is going to make the decision. That's who's got to make a decision. A three-ring arena, right? Five pillars of the community in the middle, right? 18 people around them, 200 stakeholders around them. Series of public meetings, all right? Open discussion in the Klieg Lights, television, press, everybody out there. Start with the initial question. How do we go ahead and change some things that have to happen in this school that's tearing this community apart? Keep it confined. Allow people to facilitate the discussion. Have that core group there to make a decision based on all the information and wisdom that they can. And then go with it. All right? Pretty straightforward stuff. No brain surgery. Absolutely straightforward arena building. Rejection. Because when you invite the stranger in, simply by the invitation, is a sense of loss of control. And what does that do? It does the same thing that happened to that man when he threw the box against the wall. It was the recognition that there was some condition that he had or something that he was wearing that he didn't even know. But by coming into an arena now that was balanced and where doubt was going to be celebrated, it forces people to find a mirror that gets much too close. They see things that they haven't seen before. And that's frightening. That's frightening. Other things, yes?
I really appreciate what you're saying about the need for arena building. To have that space that people can come into. I guess I'd like to question some of the edges of it a little bit. That's the important part, right? From the I think your insights about the stranger are really helping me see things in some different ways, which is helpful. What I'm questioning right now is with particular reference to your application, I think of how that is working in the situation that you were talking about with the Learning Center. And what I'm wondering is whether you whether that kind of transformative event, that ability to ask the question and see something so new, happens because a stranger asks a question, or happens because a person who is respected and holds power, maybe even in other contexts, comes into a situation. I don't know if I'm saying this very well. I think what I'm getting at is, you are a stranger to the deaf and hearing community that was happening there, and yet there's a much greater context in which you're not a stranger. There are many contexts in the world in which I'm not a stranger in a sense, because I have this, I carry this privilege with me. And, you know, I would imagine that the question about the boxes was probably asked by, you know, a 5-year-old or 7-year-old coming into that community, but could not have carried that transformative power as when you came in to the community and asked it. And
why?
You
invited to be the stranger.
By whom?
By the people themselves.
By the two cultures. I was the brilliance of that was not mine. The brilliance was the creating of a common door where I was invited as a legitimate stranger by both cultures, where I was not pretending to be deaf, I could not be. So I'm not coming in even knowledgeable about that. What I was able to do was to be as honest as I could about the fact of what I didn't know. I wasn't pretending to be an expert in deaf culture. But I also hopefully was being very honest about being about recognizing that I don't believe I really understood the hearing culture. I mean, I operate among hearing people because I am part of that group. But it has to do with the fish question, okay? This is a great. I was invited to Toronto to give a talk to the people up there in the deaf schools. And I had the opportunity, I came up with this discussion with them about, you know, what's the difficulty of raising these questions about culture. It's the same issue that if fish could talk, you know, if you had a discussion with a fish, you know, and said, tell me about your life, you know, the last thing the fish would talk about would be water. Because the notion of water and the fish are in fact fused. There is no separation between it. And in fact, culture, I think, is that same thing to us. That we operated in such a way that other people can see us and see this notion of context and culture. But when you ask somebody on the inside, they're a fish. Because it's the most difficult thing for them to describe. I don't mean to jump real far, but just hang in there with me. We've been doing some intercultural research for the last 2 years. French, German, Americans. Okay. Very briefly, we 10 mediators from France, 10 from Germany, 10 from the U.S., all of whom were bilingual in one of the other two languages. So language got to be a key variable. Okay. One of the things that we wanted to look at over and over again was, even among people who are schooled as negotiators, okay, but clearly coming from one national culture, what happens when you put them in a condition where you begin to go ahead and create variety and permutations in national cultures and availability of language? I mean, you can play with it. You can understand all the different variations you get. But more importantly, not so much how they negotiate with one another. What happens when you put people outside of that negotiation, observing the negotiations that are going on, and attempting somehow to describe the culture that they see? See what I'm saying? That's the question. So what do we find? We find that in terms of requesting somebody individually, their ability to describe a cultural event and describe it in a certain way, they have got almost zero utility. There is almost an absolute impossibility for individuals from various cultures, even observing groups that are their own culture or interacting with other cultures, from being able to have any consistent context by which they're going to describe a specific act as being French or German or American, a combination. Three times. we took all 30 people, we had them meet in Germany, we had them meet in France, we had them meet in the United States. But you know what we found? When you ask them as a group, you take all the 10 Germans, you take all the 10 French, and all the 10 Americans, right? And you now ask them to be able to report on conditions that they see in the other culture. They have great consistency among themselves. They have a very clear picture that they're able to describe about. The Americans are able to describe about the French, or are able to describe about the Germans, and vice versa. With very, you know, all the wonderful things research, very small standard deviations, meaning that they had a very singular response from particular groups. So what we expect people to do individually, they cannot do. But when they find themselves associated with a common cultural group attempting to describe another cultural group or phenomenon, they become much better at it. They're capable of being able to do it. The fascinating question is, why? Why is that condition? What's behind it? And we think it's critical because it has something to do with being able to unlock a little bit more about understanding the conflict systems between minority and majority groups and cultures and ethnic groups. And we have to stop this. Yes, I'll take another question.
What's the goal for the forums these next 3 days? What is it? To present to people here at Holden the two different cultures in order for them to see in their mind that it's the parallel, similar parallels with other cultural conflicts or conflicts on any level? Is your goal to create an arena for the people here to put doubts on the table? Or is your goal to learn yourself? But why are you here at Holden this week?
Certainly the third one. For me to learn more. Regarding the second one, to create an arena for the people here, I don't think I've got the time to be able to do it, and it really isn't in the intent, and it would really be false to set up that expectation. But in terms of the first condition, to be able to talk about this in such a way as to be able to understand what may be similarities or whatnot regarding that condition and others, certainly, hopefully, that would be something that would go on down the line. Now, here's the issue. I can give information and I can talk about my experiences and what I know, as well as ways of framing things. Where you want that to go in terms of the application of that information or the testing of those ideas, whether it is in any of those arenas that you mentioned, or if it is very specifically with some very specific issues that you have at hand right now. That's up to you, and I would be more than happy to follow it down that course. If you wanted to bring something into this discussion that would focus it in terms of issues or conditions that are currently you are dealing with or you see dealing with, to help us be able to go ahead and take this discussion further, I'd be open for that. And I'm, like I said, this is a dialogue rather than a lecture. And so the path it takes, I never come in with lecture notes. I simply come in with a menu. And I think it's a force, if we choose what we want to take off of that menu and to be able to go forward. So.
I have a question on this statement. I hope that at some point that we'd be able to discuss a little bit, you know, culture and power in the church, how the church controls. the minority groups, and, you know, attempts to develop their spiritual connectedness with God. So, an example, you said that the man threw that box against the wall, and at my deaf church, they threw away singing, and that was a big statement for them to make, and it shocked a lot of other people, but it's something like that that I'd like to discuss at greater length later.
Sounds great. I invite you to do it, and I would invite you to think about it, how we can deal with that tomorrow, because I want to talk about power. When I say talk about power, I very briefly, at the very beginning, want to line out the six aspects of power. And then my question to you will be, let's see how these variables play out in conditions. And if one of them is to be able to raise it in the context of church power and minorities, please let's do it. If we can frame it in hearing and deaf conditions, let's do it. But I would invite that discussion take place tomorrow.